Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins. And man, are we going to have fun today because we have the best guest ever. I'm just kidding. I'm not kidding that we have a great show for you today, but you'll see what I mean by that joke. Hey, but before we get to Linda P. Jones in today's show, have you ever wondered if there's a way to capitalize on all that online chatter, the millions of investors on social media? Well, guess what? Your wait's over because the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, that's now at your fingertips and you can make their edge your edge. It's called the Buzz Index. It's licensed to an exchange traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZs. Invest in the most talked about positions online. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. And now the star of today's show, Linda P. Jones.
I am so excited to welcome to the podcast, Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins. How are you, Joe?
I'm fantastic, Linda. You and I don't get to talk enough. So
I know. Well, you and I are co-hosts of the Money Tree Investing Podcast, of course, with two of our other co-hosts, and we have such a great time each week. I honestly have to say it's one of the highlights of just hearing your voice, and you make me laugh every Wednesday morning when we do our show, and it's such a joy and a pleasure. So I'm so excited to have you all to myself today. Yay!
Well, I'm very excited to be here with you. I'm glad that you asked, and I know that we're going to help people a lot with, you know, deciding what they think about a financial planner, because that's pretty important.
It's super important, and you know, I really haven't covered this topic, but today we're going to talk about clues that a financial advisor might not be a good fit for you. And I think that is a topic that a lot of people want to know. First of all, I get asked a lot, where do you find one? So we'll cover that. But also, once you find one, how do you know if they're not right for you? So where do you think people should go to find a financial advisor?
Yeah, I think the first place people should go is to people that are like them, or people that they maybe look up to but have similar circumstances. They're kind of where you want to be, but not too far ahead. You don't want to have a financial advisor working with people vastly different than you. Really, I was a financial planner for 16 years, and as much as anything, it was about having somebody in your corner that can do two things. They can identify with your plight, whatever your plight may be, on one hand. And on the other hand, there's somebody, for me, that's a little bit of a Gordon Ramsay, you know, the chef guy, that will be on your team. Like, whenever Gordon Ramsay's on television, for people that don't know this chef, he always comes into an episode of his kitchen nightmare show, and he gets in a big fight with the chef and the people that own the restaurant, right? We don't want that guy. But at the second half of it, of the show, usually the way the formula works is he's kind of got his arm around them and he's disagreeing with them, but he's still on their team. And for me, that's kind of what I'm looking for in not just a financial advisor, but for somebody who is a fitness coach, somebody who's a dietitian, whatever. Somebody who's going to say, you know what, Joe, I know you love donuts and I know they taste great, but a donut is not phenomenal for who you're trying to be a year from now or 2 years from now. And then you go, yeah, okay, I get it. So I start there. I definitely don't finish there, though. So that gives me an idea of who is going to be a good fit for me. And then once I meet somebody, or once I get a recommendation, then I go and I meet them. But even before that, I can use a few tools. There's a great tool called BrokerCheck. I can go and I can look and see if the person has had any problems that have been reported. Give an example. When I was a financial planner, I had a client where, Linda, I identified a problem that this client had had with a former advisor, and the client filed a grievance against the company, against the old advisor, and against me, even though I'm the one that pointed it out. What's cool is the complaint is in detail, and I don't even know if it's there. I haven't looked in a while if the complaint's still there, because I don't know how long it takes them to get rid of somebody that no longer has licenses to get rid of their broker check record. But if it is there, what you'll see is that there's this complaint. It tells you a little bit about it. You'll also see that during my 16-year career, I had one complaint. And you'll also be able to then ask me, because obviously one problem on an advisor's record is not damning of them. But if they have problem after problem after problem after problem, you start to see a pattern. But for even a guy like me, if you would have come in and met with me, you'd say, Joe, what's this problem that you had with this client? That brings up a great conversation with the advisor about how they work and why they'd have a problem with a client, which, you know, those conversations end up, I think, going really well. It gives you more clues as to whether you're going to be a good fit or whether you're not going to be a good fit. Finally, I think a certified financial planner, somebody is a certified financial planner, it means they went through some very intense training and courses and passed a harrowing test to get that. And then they have continuing education requirements to keep that designation. I think that while that's not the end all, like I wouldn't hire somebody, Linda, because they're a CFP, but I certainly like that as one of the hurdles for somebody to jump. I knew some CFPs who were morons. So that's not, I'm not going to say that's a reason to hire them, but it is one of the check boxes that I'd like to see that shows that they at least have a bottom standard of being acceptable.
Right. Well, you bring up a few good points here. First of all, the Gordon Ramsay analogy, I really like that. And that to me sounds more like a financial planner, which is kind of the coach that can cover a broader array of topics than a financial advisor. So let's talk about the difference between a financial planner and a financial advisor, because a lot of financial planners are certified financial planners, CFPs. They have the designation. They don't have to, but if they do, obviously it's extra education they've gone through, and having been there ourselves, we know how difficult that is. What do you think? Does someone need to have a financial planner, a financial advisor, or when do they go to which?
I think it depends on what you're really looking for, to your point. A lot of times, financial advisors are people that just deal with investing, where a financial planner will work with the six areas of financial planning, which include your – let's see if I can get these all at the top of my head without any notes in front of me – your financial position, which includes your net worth and getting your budget together, your debt, that type of thing. Your risk management, like if you go through an extended period where you don't have any income, do you have a cash reserve through your homeowners, your car insurance, your life insurance strategy? On that note, your tax planning, your estate plan, your investment plan, and then your retirement plan. And some people ask, well, how's your retirement plan different than your investment plan? Retirement plans include things like, when do I take Social Security, right? How do I have money coming out of my accounts instead of going into my accounts, which is a lot of what investing's about. So a financial planner will cover all those things. My best clients were great investors, Linda. They were great. And I couldn't imagine them having somebody in their corner telling them how to invest better. What they really wanted was somebody who could do things that they already knew how to do, but somebody that would do it much faster. As an example, I could probably build a car. My dad worked for General Motors. I know how a car runs. I'm familiar with the technology and kind of where the pieces go. Not especially handy, but I could probably build one. I prefer to hire that done because I can just focus on the things I'm good at instead of deciding every single piece of the car. Most of my clients at the end of my career as a financial planner were those type of people. They could do all the stuff I could do. I could just do it much faster so they could focus on how do I make money? How do I make sure that the areas where I'm weak, I'm filling in those holes, and my strengths, I'm doing more of that. So a financial planner, a good financial planner, I think, is almost like an agent or a manager on your team. If you're, you know, think of yourself as Linda P. Jones, the rock star, and I'm Joe Saul Sehy, the rock star's manager. My job is to tell you, hey, we need to have this many fans by this time next year, i.e., if I'm working toward a goal, I want to have this much money toward that goal next year. Here's the things that are going on with the new tax code, Linda. I think you need to take advantage of this thing with the new tax law, this thing with the new tax law. You can forget about the rest. Like somebody who takes all this information and just tells you what's relevant to you, that's what I think a good financial planner does versus just an advisor who probably wants to invest your money for you.
Yeah, and the advisor can be more focused on the investment portion, whereas the planner, as you mentioned, had the six broad areas of coverage, which can be totally different because they could be fee-based and charge a fee for a written financial plan if they're a financial planner versus a financial advisor isn't really going to do that, right? They're just going to help with their investments and their investment plan and that kind of thing, talking with couple or the individual and getting their investment plan organized.
My favorite part of the whole process of meeting with clients was sitting down and focusing on those things, Linda, that we could control. And I think that a lot of times with a financial advisor will start off a conversation with, well, here's what the market's doing, and here's what so-and-so, and here's the strategy of these managers, these active managers that we're using, and it's all a bunch of gobbledygook. I preferred to sit down with my client and say, okay, Linda, we need to be at X amount of money by today. That was our goal that we stated we were going to have the last time we met, maybe 6 months ago. And here's where we're at today. And if we're ahead of the game, that facilitates one discussion, not about the markets, but about what you are going to do, the things that you can control, versus a whole different discussion if we say, hey, Linda, you're behind by $15,000 or $20,000 from that benchmark that we set 6 months ago. We can look at the reasons why we're behind, but then we also develop a plan of what you're going to do differently, focusing again on what you could control. And I think that's where the power is. People talk a lot about fees when it comes to investments. That's an important dragon to fight. It's not the most important dragon. The dragon I think it's the most important is that people don't save enough. They don't do they don't talk enough about the things that they can control and control those aspects of their financial life.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We get focused on the fees, and the fees aren't the end all be all. And it depends what you're getting for your fees, obviously, too. If you're getting a lot of service, a lot of added value, then it's worth paying for. But if you're not, then it's a whole nother question. So what are some kind of warning signs that maybe a financial advisor isn't really working well for you?
This is my favorite topic. Actually, we can even start, Linda, if you want, with you go to meet with that advisor for the first time and you walk into their office. I think you can tell from the reception area. How about that? You can tell from the reception area of an advisor's office a lot of clues about whether this is going to be a fit or not. You walk into a financial advisor, financial planner's office, look at the receptionist. If the receptionist greets you happily, is very comforting, is somebody who's made to or is trained to help you get in the right frame of mind to have a great planning discussion, I think that stuff isn't just – sometimes it's a receptionist who's really just good at their job, but that stuff usually emanates from the top. And a lot of times I would walk into – because my practice was all over the metro Detroit area, so I would end up meeting people in different offices. And some of the receptionists were absolutely horrible, and I knew it was because the person that owned that office was a horrible boss, and he was a rotten advisor. And so if the receptionist isn't happy to be there, guess what? You're probably not going to be happy to be there either. There was a very close correlation between that. You visited a lot of financial advising offices. Did you notice the same thing?
I did notice some of that, although many of the offices I visited were in the same firm that I worked for. So
yeah.
I walked in, they knew me. I wasn't an unknown person.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But I hear what you're saying. The first impression is the receptionist. What's the next impression? What's the next thing?
Just look at the reception area itself. I'll tell you, a financial planning meeting. I mean, you know, as a financial planner, I had to put myself in the head and the mood of people coming to visit me. You're bearing your soul. You haven't showed anybody these numbers. You're talking about your biggest goals and your dreams as somebody that you don't know that well. So people come in, they're generally on edge, they're nervous, they're not sure. They don't feel like they've done enough sometimes. They think that the advisor is going to beat them up a little bit. So they're worried. If you walk into an advisor's office or a planner's office and there's a television and that television's on one of the financial shows and it's go, 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 buy, 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 sell, 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 stock market all day, horrible. Because that shows me that the advisor is going to probably position themselves as a stock jockey or that they're somehow omniscient and they know what's going to happen. Versus the fact that most of us don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We obviously want to we want to do our homework, but I loved walking into offices where the Travel Channel was on, or something that was much more calming. Oh, and advisors that had like political news on, and so they're focused on, once again, things that we can't directly control. Again, they haven't given a lot of thought to the overall client experience. So I really want to look at what magazines are out. Are they stock jock magazines or are they more lifestyle magazines? What's playing on the television? And then just how ornate is it? Like I want my advisor to be successful, but I don't want it to be just over the top wealthy because, you know, we get back to that fee point, Linda. I don't want all my fees going so that my advisor is at the Taj Mahal.
Yeah, exactly. So let's say this is a couple walking into the financial advisor's office. Now they've come through the lobby, they've met the receptionist, they've sat there for a minute, they've checked out the whole area. Now they're walking into the financial advisor's office. Now what do you do to make some decisions about the advisor?
Yeah, very first thing. I like, and I couldn't do this. This was a flaw in my system. I love it when the advisor greets you themselves. I didn't have time. I was very had a lot of meetings back to back, so I'd have my assistant bring somebody back. But we also had a game plan there for, once again, calming, helping people relax and get in the right mood to have some fun with their financial plan. I don't like it when the advisor sits behind a desk in a really comfortable chair, and then the couple or the individual sits on the other side of the desk in a much crappier chair, much, much less comfortable. And then I always feel like in those offices, like they're there to kiss the ring of the king or queen, you know?
Well, you feel like you're in the principal's office and you're in trouble.
Yeah, it totally feels. They got this high back chair and they sit back. Well, Linda, let me tell you what you did wrong today. I don't like that power play. I like advisors who, and there were plenty of advisors that did this, had a separate table in their office, maybe a round table. In my case, it was oblong, but where we're all sitting together, the same chairs at a table away from that desk. So there's no power play going on. We're all on a team together. That tells me a lot that the advisors thought about that relationship and that they want to be in your corner instead of dictate from on high. I also like a whiteboard. You know, I like advisors that are going to teach me concepts. So if an advisor has a whiteboard and they get up and they, you know, I don't want to say dumb down a concept. They want to make a concept easier that might start off seeming intimidating. You know, like I remember explaining to people how a mutual fund worked using this analogy of a window pane. And I draw just a window with a lot of different panes, with 9 different panes up on the whiteboard, and show how that was the basis of a mutual fund. You know, if a rock goes through one of those panes, you still have the other 8 panes and a mutual fund's diversification. And it's amazing how with just a little creativity, an advisor can become somebody that's going to make you smarter with investments instead of somebody who's going to take it from you and do it for you. I personally don't want somebody who's going to do it for me. I want somebody who's going to do the legwork for me, but I want to walk out of there smarter about my money than I was before I walked in.
And I think, you know, from the woman's perspective, it's important to feel respected and given attention to as much as the man is in the room. And sometimes I've heard that doesn't happen. So I think that's a really important point, that financial advisors really should give equal time and attention to spouses and not just talk to one and ignore the other, especially if the other one is the breadwinner. Sometimes the woman is actually the main breadwinner and has actually been ignored, which just doesn't make any sense to me, but apparently
I would get frustrated in meetings when I would see a male spouse do that. And I'd have a male spouse walk in with a macho chip on his shoulder, would immediately want to get in the weeds with me about a bunch of irrelevant crap instead of talking about the budget and our goals and our feelings about those goals and where we want to go and what we want to do. And I remember on several occasions having to back down, and often, I'd say 99% of the time, it was the man. I'd have to back the man down and say, let's make this a meeting that we can all be in instead of you and I just trying to one-up each other about who knows more.
So that's a good point, that clients have to be good clients too and not have to try and show up the financial advisor or show how they know more or they're better or, you know, put downs or whatever. So that's a good point too. So how much time do we give a financial advisor? If someone has a new financial advisor, how long does it take to determine if they're really good and if there's someone you should stick with or someone that isn't working for you?
I think most of the, if you're hiring a financial advisor the way that I would, which is for education and communication, making it so somebody's doing the legwork, the stuff that I could probably already do, but they can do it quicker, then you're going to know fairly soon whether they're communicating the way that you want them to communicate, whether they're, you know, they're not talking over your head. I just had somebody write to me with this type of question saying, I love my advisor and they do phenomenally well for me with my investments. The problem I have, I don't understand what the hell we're doing. That to me is the fundamental issue. If you don't understand what you're doing and your advisor passes away, what do you do next? You know, advisor gets hit by a truck. I'm not sure where you go from there. So I think you know fairly quickly if it's a fit or not. And I don't think you leave right away. I think you have to have the guts to address the issue with the advisor. Just say, you know, I think there's a communication gap. Here's what I expected, and here's what you're giving me. And it's not that it's right or wrong. It's just this is what I wanted, and I'm not sure if you can fit that. If you can fit that, then let's stay together. If you can't fit that, it's probably best for both of us that I move on.
I think it's so important that people do understand what their advisor's doing, because otherwise they're open to a Bernie Madoff. I mean, you know, the whole thing with Bernie Madoff was, oh, you're going to make your 10% year in, year out, no matter what the market does, you're going to make 10%. Well, people didn't understand. How was he making 10% when the market wasn't making 10%? And they didn't understand. And he just kept patting them on the head saying, you know, everything's okay and you're going to make your 10%. And it turned out that it was a big fat fraud. So I think it's super important that people do understand exactly what the strategy is and how they're accomplishing that.
Me too. And it's difficult sometimes. I always felt bad with some clients that had some severe estate planning issues. And with the new tax law, those, you know, there's going to be a lot fewer of those people with the estate tax being raised like it was. But, you know, we started getting into some of these permanent life insurance policy things, the 1% or 2% of people where these actually make sense, Linda. I felt bad for my client because I'm like, I think I could explain this all day, and I'm fairly certain you're still not going to get it. But the other 98% of the time, you know, excluding that or some of the charitable strategies that you do, or maybe a strategy involving a child that can't take care of themselves as an adult, maybe those types of things, you should be able to write it on a napkin. I love this guy, David Chilton, the Wealthy Barber, this great older Canadian book on financial planning. And he says, if you can't write the gist of your strategy on a napkin, it's probably too complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are tax laws and strategies that are complicated, but it doesn't mean, I mean, you know, it can be explained and it can
right.
be understood, but it is complicated. I mean, certainly you're not going to be a tax professional listening to, you know, them explain all of that. It can get very complex, but it's important to understand why you're doing the things you're doing and how that all works. And
you can even ask them for resources. You know, often I would give my clients resources to read. I like Rick Edelman's The Truth About Money, if somebody wanted the basics between our meetings, you know, that I think very similarly to the way Rick does on a lot of topics. So I would refer them to that. Or if somebody had a debt problem, they were just starting out, you know, I would have them read Dave Ramsey for people just starting out. I think that's a great read for people later on, maybe not so much. But I try to identify authors so if people wanted more information outside of our meeting. Once again, I can help them cut through the big number of books out there, or resources out there, and tell them which ones are really going to help them individually.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And having just written my book, which hasn't come out yet, one of the big things that I talk about is how couples aren't always on the same page. A lot of times a spouse, predominantly the husband, has really good intent of being kind of a family patriarch who takes care of the spouse. And oftentimes, and it's often the wife, not always, but often the wife, doesn't really understand everything that's happening. And getting on the same page just so that they understand and know what's going on, so that in case anything happens to the spouse, is so important. How do you recommend that couples get on the same page?
Well, two things, and sticking with the financial advisor theme, if only one person in the couple goes to meet the financial advisor, even if you delegate the tasks so that this is what generally he does or she does and the other one doesn't take care of that part, man, I want to see both of you. Because the thing that stinks, even if you sit there and you don't understand anything, if your spouse dies – and you're stuck in this office with this person you've never met before, maybe you met once. You're now paired with them as your partner, and you don't know how they think. You don't know how they correspond with you. You don't know anything. that's a tough spot to be in, especially when you're emotional. So I like seeing the couple come to every financial planning meeting together. It's actually kind of funny, Linda, because there were some meetings we would have such great meetings that I was very, very certain that that couple was going to have great sex that night. Like it was going to be a fun night at their house because the financial plan was going well. They were communicating better. And, you know, just when the communication lines are open, I don't know, for a financial planner, it felt like I should have been playing some Barry White sometimes. But on the other aspect, and maybe a little bit less uncomfortable, I love the idea of a weekly meeting. You know, and it's not a long meeting. And I've seen people call this a monthly meeting or a quarterly meeting. I don't think those are often enough. I like a weekly meeting over dinner, maybe even at a restaurant. If you use an app like something like Clarity Money or Mint or Empower or one of those, you know, money tracking things, take those out on your phone, walk through your recent transactions, talk about bills that are coming up in the next month, talk about your family's big goals that are coming up. Cheryl and I, as an example, we have a vacation in September. So we decided to establish this simple fund. We have money to pay for it right now, but we thought it'd be fun to set up as a challenge to pay for it with cash that we don't yet have. So we set up a Rise account online, and we have money going from monies that we make into this Rise account, and we're building this Germany vacation as we go. And it's just something fun that we're doing together. And I love that. And when we have our weekly meeting, I find and that communication line's very open. I find that the next week goes really well. When we don't, because we're very busy people, slowly but surely the wheels start to come off the bus a little, and we start seeing that, you know, we don't handle our money as well the next few weeks. We might go out to eat more than we probably should. We don't meal plan enough. Which, by the way, it's funny. We could probably go out to restaurants to eat fairly often. Not only do I feel healthier, I actually enjoy making dinner at home. And so when we take that time to do the meal plan and grocery shop together, set ourselves a budget just for groceries, it ends up being fantastic for our relationship.
Yeah, well, you can tell that you're on the same page, and that is what's so important. You know, we know that most couples fight about money, and it's one of the most contentious things about marriage, but it doesn't have to be, because look how you and Cheryl set that up for success. You have a common goal that you're both working toward. There's no judgment and criticism. There's no blame. It's being on the same page and appreciating what the other person is doing, and then both working toward the same goals. And I think oftentimes couples get kind of messed up because one wants one thing and another wants another thing, and they don't have that overlap of common area of being on the same page. And so, you know, there ends up being this tug of war and this push and pull.
Yeah, and sometimes, Linda, they're unavoidable. But while there are fights that would be avoidable, but it's not that people are off the deep end. And I'll give you an example, because before we set up these weekly meetings, I remember coming home one day. I knew where all of the dollars were. Cheryl kind of knew where the dollars were. And I walked in, and she had a bunch of new clothes for our twins. And I knew we didn't have the money for the clothing, but we hadn't talked. And we had this massive argument that we could have just avoided. You know, we could have totally avoided it had we had a discussion ahead of time about it. I'm somebody who very much likes board games. And I remember other times where we hadn't had our talk in a while, a new board game would come out, and I'd come home with a board game, and Cheryl goes, "Where the hell are you getting the money for that?" So whether it's school clothes or board games or whatever it might be, if you have a plan ahead of time, if you talk about it, hey, guess what? There's this, you know, school starting next week. We got to have clothing for the kids. All right, what are we going to budget for that? And then you're working together on it. Or there's this hot new board game that, you know, we really like to pick up. It's going to be $60. Where's that money going to come from? Well, here's what we do to afford that. Then when we come home with either school clothes or board games, it makes it sound like she's worried about much more important stuff than I am, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know, but I think it's just important. The information sharing is so important, rather than you know, one person being in the dark and the other person knowing everything, or things being secretive, or people just having their own agenda, running in different directions, not being on the same page. And it's just so important to get it out in the open and be working in the same direction. I think that will make a marriage better, and it will make certainly their finances better.
It's so much more fun too. I'll just say that the fun factor is so much better. And you know what? And for people that are single, if you have a budgeting buddy, just having somebody that you're talking to that you're budgeting with, you might not go into detail as much, but this, you can't say enough about masterminds, Linda, and accountability partners. Those are huge.
Yes, I agree. Love that. Well, Joe, this has been fantastic to talk with you today. Tell everyone where they can get more from you.
We have a podcast that comes out every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, where people learn a lot here on Be Wealthy and Smart. Linda, you know, if you learn something listening to our show, Stacking Benjamins, you should probably keep it to yourself, because our show is based on the science of play, and we really have, it's a financial variety show, and we have a lot of fun. And like you do here, we have fantastic guests. But our conversations are shorter, less in-depth. We try to introduce you to people and to concepts and then let people find great places like this. I have a new show out, which is not an hour long like the Stacking Benjamins show. It's called Money in the Morning, and it's a 15-minute show where it's just a couple headlines. And so on one recent show, there were two headlines. One was about this. Did you see this jewelry heist at the Ritz Hotel in Paris, where they made off with $4.5 million worth of jewelry?
No.
They ended up finding the jewelry. But we take headlines like that and talk about, so what does this have to do with you? Well, if you own anything expensive like jewelry, collectibles, you want to have those appraised and you want to get a rider on your homeowners or on your renter's insurance. So we take some headlines that are in the news. We tie them to things in your financial plan. And every morning, you know, for 15 minutes, you get some good basic information based on stuff that's happening out in the world.
Awesome. And Joe, how do they connect in with Money in the Morning?
Just wherever you listen to Be Wealthy and Smart, just type in Money in the Morning and you'll find us there. We're just about everywhere.
Gotcha. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks a ton, Linda. This is great. Thanks for having me.
Was that amazing interview with a fantastic guest, by the way? Thanks so much to Linda for that great interview. Hey, if you've ever wondered if there's a way to capitalize on all the online chatter of the millions of investors on social media, your wait's over, because the same artificial intelligence techniques that some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds use, they're at your fingertips and you can make their edge your edge. It's called the Buzz Index. It's licensed to an exchange traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZ. It provides investors with a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. There's no surveys, no guesswork. Here's how it works. First, the Buzz targets the most mentioned large cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the Buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics. And the 75 stocks that have the most bullish score, they get included in the index each month. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. And now back to Linda.
Thanks, Joe. And now for our roundtable portion, we have our real financial advisor currently with us, practicing out of Israel, Doug Goldstein. How are you?
I am practicing. I hope to make perfect pretty soon, Linda. Thanks. How are you doing?
Well, we're so excited to talk with you and get your perspective on this whole financial advisor situation, since you do it every day and the rest of us are in the business in a little bit different way. So it's going to be an interesting conversation, I think. And Miranda, how are you today?
I'm doing really well. We've got some nice weather. It's a great day. And we get to talk about Joe.
We talk about Joe and Doug. It'll be fun. And Joe, the star of our show today, how are you?
I'm good. I feel like we never talk.
I know. Well, you know, it was really interesting to hear what you had to say, having been in the business. You have an interesting perspective doing something a little bit different. And we all are involved in a different version of financial advising in one way or another, whether it's advice that we give online or advice that, in Doug's case, gives to clients in person. Kind of interesting. I think we're going to have a fun conversation today. So let's get right to it. We talked about what makes a good financial advisor, what doesn't make a good financial advisor. But I'm curious, Doug, from your perspective, actually doing it every day with clients, what do you think makes a good financial advisor?
Having a good client really makes a good financial advisor.
What does that mean?
Seriously, I think it means that the clients have to be open to the idea of seeing their investments as not being a game and not being a casino, but as being something like running a business. I often tell clients that the way they should look at themselves is they should see themselves as the CEO of their company, like the Linda P. Jones Corporation. And Linda P. Jones is the one who's in charge of steering the ship and deciding the direction that this enterprise should go. And then she maybe hires a CFO, let's say Doug Goldstein, and says, listen, Doug, I want you to handle the money side of the business. You report to me and we're going to have regular meetings and discuss what's going on. But I need you to handle the day-to-day details because I'm steering the ship and I can't be down in the hull. I can't be down there in the hull dealing with all the details.
All right. Well, that's what makes a good client. But what do you think makes a good advisor? Because, I mean, do you think that there's a part to being a good advisor that's about the advisor and not about the client?
Yeah, no, I was just kidding. It helps when there is a really good team relationship between the advisor and the client. I think that on the side of the advisor, I'll just talk about the kind of things I do, although there really are many different types of advisors, so I'm not trying to exclude one over the other. But I think that the advisor has to be the type of person who's really going to understand what the client's needs are. And in the areas that he's able to help, he's got to go ahead and help in those areas. And in areas that he doesn't have expertise, he has to know how to say, you know something, Linda, that's not what I do. I can refer you to someone, or I'll work with your accountant, or I'll work with your lawyer, but my specialty is in financial planning or asset allocation or investing, and that's the area that I'll focus on. And I think one of the other areas I just want to touch on about what Joe said is he was making a very good distinction between financial planners and investment advisors. And I think there really is a distinction, but there are many cases, and again, I'm going to include myself as well, where someone is able to work in both capacities, and not that he's a jack of all trades, but that he's able to say to the client, listen, you may not be the person who's going to go around and have a whole team of experts working for you, and you want to know that when you get to an office, there's someone who's going to watch over your overall financial plan with you, and who's going to help you to assign pieces of your portfolio, let's say, to different money managers or mutual funds or exchange-traded funds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Miranda, what did you think about my conversation with Joe where he talked about what makes a good financial advisor? Did you agree with what he had to say? Did anything come into your head about that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, really what it comes down to with your financial advisor, you need to work with somebody who understands what you're trying to accomplish with your life and with your money, and then who can help you, as Joe so often says, plan with the end in mind. So get that end figured out and work backward, and who can help you do that, and then who can take care of that management. Because the bottom line is if you're working with a financial advisor, if you're having them, whether you're having them help you with big picture things or whether you're having them help you with like smaller day-to-day things, they really need to have an understanding of what you hope to accomplish and what your goals are, so there's a better chance that they will be met.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point to begin with the end in mind. And Joe, you're always the one to remind us about that. So you did that, well on this interview as well. So you already told us what makes a good financial advisor, but I wanted to ask you, with all the robo-advisors out there and them gaining popularity, do you think that's the future, or do you think traditional financial advisors of the future? What do you think about that?
I'd love to hear what Doug has to say about this, because my personal opinion, Linda, is that the term robo-advisor is one of the worst terms of all time. Like, it really is a robo-investment slotter, right? Where it takes my investments and it slots them into different areas. Where an advisor, I mean, what a great advisor does is teaches you to do nothing. There's this cool study that Vanguard did showing that advisors add what's called alpha. A good advisor adds to your return, which is funny, by the way. This study's commissioned by a group, Vanguard, that many people who talk negatively about financial advisors use, and yet Vanguard loves financial advisors and thinks they're in your corner. But in this Vanguard study, they said the number one thing an advisor teaches you to cope, teaches you better behaviors, teaches you to do nothing when you need to do nothing. And I don't think a robo can do that. So robos haven't been tested, Linda, as you know, by a downturn in the market yet. And I'll be curious to see if that name changes, if we actually have a different name for that investing thing than robo advisor. Because I think robo something, but definitely not advisor.
Mm-hmm. So Doug, what do you think about robo advisors?
I think in the same way that a lot of people would be very uncomfortable to go to, let's say, a doctor and you sit down and it's just a computer screen. And then at the end of the day, it says, okay, now lay down on the table. I will do the surgery on you. Maybe someday in the future, this is going to be the way it's done. But I think that currently, people really do need more of a face-to-face feeling with someone. And it's not everyone. I'm not going to speak negatively about robo-advisors across the board, because actually, I think they serve a great purpose. They give a lot of people the opportunity to get into the market in a way that they wouldn't have done it. I think a lot of the robo-advisors provide certain education, but in reality, a lot of people don't bother to click in and read the education. And most people probably are not really good do-it-yourself investors, other than, of course, the Money Tree podcast audience. But other than that, people want a little help in many cases, and they might get a really, really false sense of security if they go with the robo-advisor and they say, oh, no, everything's going to be okay because I clicked, and I paid a low fee, and everything's going to be fine. Unfortunately, in a lot of places, when it comes to personal advice, you're going to get what you pay for, because if no one really gets to know who you are personally and really cares about who you are, you're going to find that you have a very non-personalized investment portfolio, and it's not a cookie cutter type of business. It's really, all investing should relate to who you are and not just say, okay, well, you're a 25-year-old, so you should have this portfolio.
Well, to put a point on what Doug's saying, Linda, it's interesting to see financial advisors embracing robo-advisors as a small portion of what they do, right? We're seeing some advisors that are delegating some of the asset management to robo-advisors. So I think that clearly shows what Doug's talking about, that it's an apple and an orange.
Well, it's really interesting because some of the robo-advisors are adding a financial advisor feature too. So they actually have access to financial advisors, and a lot of asset allocation models don't really change over time. So I can see where they can be efficient. But I think the one thing that we're all concerned about is the emotional side, because that's where we know financial advisors have value. I think their most value is when there's fear. And like Joe said, we haven't had fear in the market for a couple of years now. We haven't had, you know, a 5% correction for a couple of years. So there hasn't been the tremendous fear of, you know, a negative 38% year like we had, you know, in 2008. So I think it remains to be seen what happens during the fear portion of it. What do you think, Miranda?
I think in terms of emotion and fear and everything, I mean, people like the idea of, to a certain degree, they like the idea of having this, robo advisor who isn't thinking in terms of like emotion. Like, your robo advisor is not emotional. Your robo advisor is not going to try and beat the market. Your robo advisor is not going to try to do anything crazy. And so, to a certain degree, I mean, when you're talking about taking emotions out of the equation, you know, people kind of like that, and like they like the idea of sitting back. Now, the main problem, though, is once again, even though they like the idea of sitting back, when you're stuck in a market situation, the hardest thing to do is not check your account, right? When the market is dropping, when you're in the middle of a market event, the hardest thing to do is to stay away from your account and not look at it. When you have a financial advisor, they could talk to you about it. They could say, hey, the market's down, so everybody's down and everything's, you know, going poorly. But if you look at historical returns, then, you know, it should recover. You're well-diversified, blah, 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 blah. And that can give you some hope. If you've got the robo-advisor, the temptation is to look. And the more you look, the more nervous you get and the more likely you are to do something. And with a financial advisor, there's that kind of barrier and that wall between you. Yeah, you can make the financial advisor do something different, but it's a little bit harder and you've got that kind of space between. So I think it can work really well as long as you can convince people not to actually look at their portfolio during a market event.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting is, and I've talked with friends about this, but I haven't really heard it discussed in the industry much, but I feel like there is a lot of experience that financial advisors have. There's baby boomer aged financial advisors who really have been through a lot of ups and downs. They were there in 1987. They were there in 2000. They were there in 2008, 2009. I feel like that expertise is walking out the door, and there's a lot of maybe younger people coming in, replacing them, that haven't had the depth of experience. Doug, do you think that that is going to be an issue in the future?
Well, I started in the business about 25 years ago, and I remember 1987, not because I was in the business, but because I was in high school, and my mother at the time was in the business. So it was certainly something that I was aware of going on in the markets. But it is a real issue because if you remember a few years ago after the crash, a lot of young people weren't investing. And one of the big things that people spoke about on Wall Street was, wow, how are we going to get these people to invest? Because all these young people have known for, you know, has been this big crash and that's really shaken them up. And now we're seeing that all the young people really know is this big rise up in the market. And they're thinking, oh, well, you know, put my money in the market and make 10, 15, 20, 30% a year. And then they begin doing these calculations in their retirement plans about how many gazillions of dollars they're going to have one day, because that's what the market does. I do agree that everyone suffers from this very tunnel vision about only seeing what goes on in a period that they know about. Unfortunately, even people who have more experience sometimes only remember the recent past. But as one of the older guys now on Wall Street, I guess I would like to agree with you that people who've been around know what it feels like to have a shakeup in the market and do know probably better how to stick with it and see the forest through the trees.
Yeah. Joe, do you think a lot of experience is going to be walking out the door and that's a concern?
I think it's a concern right now. I think there's too many advisors that think that aggressiveness is fantastic on the way up that are going to realize that they might have given their clients a little too aggressive advice. And it's not that they're too aggressive for the market. I certainly think that being aggressive if you've got a long term approach is great. But from an emotional standpoint, I think there's a lot of younger advisors that don't know how to help people cope with the down market because they've never seen one. And they can, you can look somebody in the eye lender right now and say, I've got 9 years experience. And that might sound like a long time. And you've still never seen a down market.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, the industry really changed around the year 2000 when people, a lot of financial advisors moved to a more fee-based model. And what that showed me was just that there was sort of less customer contact, less client contact, less, you know, picking up the phone and talking to people because their income sort of stabilized and was steadily rolling in without talking to people. And so that became a concern. Do you think, Miranda, that people still want that one-on-one conversation with the financial advisor, and that's important?
I think to a certain degree it is. I think younger people might not care as much about it, but I think once you get to a certain point in terms of what you have for assets, I think the more assets you have, the more interested you are in talking to somebody. I think it's one of those things where if you're just putting things on automatic and you're just saving long-term for retirement, talking to somebody might not be the thing. But once you start adding more goals, once you start adding goals like, oh, well, I want to save for my child's college. Oh, I have more assets. You know, I have more than, you know, $100,000 or $250,000 that's available to me in assets. How do I allocate them in a way that makes more sense? How do I reach other goals that I have? How do I set up for, you know, creating an income portfolio? So once you start having more assets and more goals, then having, you know, actually sitting down and talking to somebody becomes a little more attractive, I think.
Yeah. Well, all of this new technology and what they call fintech is going to be very interesting to see how it all works out. And some things I think are going to really take and be successful and prove themselves to be improvements, and others are not. So we'll see, you know, what people want and what really works to help people and, you know, be better investors and get better investment performance in the future. So thank you all for being on today with us and talking about this interesting topic. Doug, tell us what's going on with Goldstein on Gelt.
Yeah, I just had a great interview with Ken Granbach, who is a fellow who studies demographics. And we talk about the optimism of a millennial economy. And it's a great interview and a great show, which you can find at goldsteinongelt.com.
That sounds fantastic. I'll have to listen to that. And Joe, what's going on at Stacking Benjamins?
15,000 people last year filed complaints with the government about what are called sweetheart romance scams, where somebody romanced them out of a bunch of cash. And we have Sandra Bernardo from Experian on to talk about protecting yourself that way from online scammers who you think might love you, but it turns out are just after your wallet.
Oh, dear. Well, that sounds like a good one too. I'll have to listen to that one as well. And on Be Wealthy and Smart, we have 6 misconceptions about millionaires. Miranda, what's going on at Planting Money Seeds or adulting.tv?
Yeah. So over at adulting.tv, we have an article about how you're probably saving enough. You're just putting it in the wrong place. So, we talk about, you know, what you should do with your money. If you're planning on putting in an emergency fund, where to hold that, what to do with your money. If you're saving for retirement. Because the way you save and where you put that money really depends on what you're planning to do with it and when. So head on over to adulting.tv for that article.
Fantastic. Miranda, would you please take us home?
Yeah, thank you so much for listening to the Money Tree Podcast. You can get all of these episodes and more at moneytreepodcast.com. You can also subscribe to us using Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and even Google Play. We're on all the devices. So go ahead and subscribe and make sure you never miss an episode. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.